Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are the Beatle Brains of Ireland, and we host Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles.
We might look at Beatles albums, we might tell you what books you need to be taking on holiday. We've done an episode from Abbey Road Studios, and we do live shows.
We've also had guests on our podcast, like Beatles biographer Mark Lewison and singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock. Search for Nothing Is Real on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Available 8 days a week.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin. When we started the podcast, if you go back and listen to our introductory episode, we speculated from time to time we would have special guests. And we didn't realise back then that our first guest would be the one and only Mark Lewison. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
And welcome to the Nothing Is Real studio penthouse. If you're listening to this podcast, you already know who Mark Lewison is, I hope. But on the off chance you don't, he's the world's leading expert and historian about the Beatles, publishing his first book on the subject, The Beatles Live, in 1986, and going up to his most recent publication in 2013, The Beatles, All These Years, Volume 1, Tune In. The first of a projected three-volume biography on the band. Volume 1 in its unabridged form, covering up to the end of 1962 after the release of their debut single. And Mark is currently on tour with Hornsey Road, a two-hour show about the Beatles' Abbey Road, which is what has brought him to Dublin this weekend. And Abbey Road is just coincidentally celebrating its 50th anniversary at the minute, and it also happens to be at number one this weekend. Open brackets, not number one in Ireland, but number one in the proper UK charts. I've checked. And it deserves to be at number one, which is incredible after 50 years. So maybe we'll start a bit with Hornsey Road. How come you're doing this at this time?
Once Tune In came out, I started to receive offers to invitations to do lectures, principally in America, at colleges, universities, and so on. And it's nice to be asked to do those things. And like everybody else, I need to put food on the table. So every once in a while, I will say yes to an invitation. I pick and choose them. But when I do a presentation, they take a lot of work, and I don't do anything half-heartedly ever. So as you spend weeks putting something together, you begin, no matter how much the fee might be, you begin to resent spending so much time on it. Even though I can spend as much or as little time as I like, but once you start out to do something well, it can take time. And so I did a White Album talk last November for the 50th anniversary at a symposium in Monmouth, New Jersey. And it took quite a long time to put together, and I was beginning to resent it. Not that that was their fault, but it was my own. And when I got back to England, it's a long story, this, but when I got back to England, I went out for dinner with some people, and one of them was a man from Phil McIntyre Promotions.
Oh, yes.
And a big Beatles fan and a reader of Tune In. And he said to me, "What have you been doing?" And I told him just that. And I said, "The drag is that you do all that work and you only do it once." And he said, "Well, you could do a tour. You could do a tour of it. You know, I could book you into theatres and you could do it." And, "Really? Well, yeah, okay." The White Album anniversary was gone. Theatres booked months in advance. Yeah. So we couldn't get anywhere before the spring of this year. And the White Album was last year. Not that I'm a great believer in everything having to be anniversaries, but nonetheless. So he said to me, "Just anticipate the next anniversary and start planning it now, and we'll book you in." So the Abbey Road album, obviously, 50 years, September 2019. So from about January of this year, we've been planning this tour. And he booked all the venues, 25 venues, 25 dates, and quite a big tour. So I'm now from being a writer who works very quietly in isolation, I'm suddenly out there as an entertainer on stage for 25 nights.
And does that give you any, I know it might seem a strange question, any insight into your writing about entertainers and performers? Has this little taste of the road given you an insight you didn't have before?
It has. A couple of things, for example. One is the fact that you spend such a lot of time in the van on the road going from show to show, and that, what a drag that is.
Yes.
Even though, you know, I've got a very nice tour manager and we get along very well and we talk easily, it's just like it's a lot of miles on the clock, and it does get a bit wearisome. And finding hotels late at night. I mean, these are the Beatles. Every touring band has had these adventures, and I'm not in a band, and I'm not a teenager, but I'm nonetheless going through that. Another one, just a simple one, on the very first night of the tour, which was Northampton, I realised that in every theatre dressing room, you've got a loudspeaker that enables you to hear the show.
Mm.
Now, because I'm on, I am the show, but you can still hear all the auditorium warming up, and you can hear people going to their seats, and you can hear bits of conversation, and if there's anyone on the stage sorting out something technical, you can hear all of that because you have that live feed coming into your dressing room. And it made me realise that when the Beatles were on tour in the UK, they would have had one of those in every room, every dressing right. room. And so they would have been able to hear the incredible acclaim for them that was ruining everybody else's act, because they were always on last, and all the preceding acts all had to perform to the wall of "We want the Beatles," and screaming. And they would have been able to hear that yeah. before they went on. And what an amazing thing that must have been for them.
Yeah.
So that was a nice little realization.
And the show focuses on Abbey Road, and one of the big things in the lead up to the show coming out was this September 1969 tape that was reported in the papers everywhere. And I'm always fascinated by September 1969. I think we both are, because everything seems to change from the 1st of September to the 30th of September.
Yes.
And I guess I kind of want to ask you about, do you think that's the key month when, you know, what's going on in August is different to what's possible in October?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, undoubtedly. I think by October, well, we know that John was no longer a Beatle by then.
Yes.
He just was encouraged not to say anything.
Yeah.
So he didn't.
But there's still odd bits of activity. So one thing I read recently was that he's playing Abbey Road when at the ICA when Yoko and himself are showing their movies.
Yeah.
And it's pre-release. And I think, well, that's a guy who's still kind of proud. It's interesting that we think of the John and Yoko and the Beatles stuff as being totally separate.
Yes.
But he still just sees this as a big artistic continuum, even in that early part of September.
I agree with that. I agree with that. And people get very het up about and very formulaic in the way they think about things. But I think that they were just open-minded artists, and it was a new piece of work, and why not play it at a public event? And he was doing those film screenings, and why not play it?
Yeah.
I was shocked to realise that he played it to the film Self-Portrait.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe Maxwell Silverhammer was the was being bang-banged at the time.
Yeah. Right, yes, yes. But no, I don't think that they thought so tightly, and they were the definition of artists who thought openly.
Yes.
And nothing was confined to strict little pigeonhole boxes.
But there's still, and sorry, I know I'm doing all the talking here, but I mean, we've, it seems that, you know, Ringo had left the band, George had left the band, but Paul probably knew that something was up with John. And I think the other thing that Paul isn't given credit for is that he had a 10-day-old baby at home. He's a new father, so he's got baby brain as well. So he's not, you know, he's thinking about other things as well.
Absolutely. But the meeting where John said to Paul, "I want a divorce," can't have come as a great surprise to Paul.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was suggesting that they go back on the road at that point, but they've been discussing that on and off for 2-3 years.
Yeah.
And the irony is that actually George went on the road in December of that year, and John was playing gigs. He'd just come back from Toronto.
So Paul got the message, "We don't want to go on the road with you." Is that really it?
No, I honestly, when I was putting the White Album talk together last year, I realised that they quite clearly must have had an arrangement within themselves, within the foursome, that they, from 67, maybe even earlier, that maybe even from 66, that they could do things separately as well.
Yes.
And it didn't, not everything had to be under the umbrella of Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if you look at it really, they had been doing separate things all along.
Yes.
I mean, John doing a book in 1964, book, yeah. for example,
Do you think that would have been an explicit arrangement?
I think they could do
Family Way or Wonderwall or Electronic Sound.
Absolutely. And Ringo could go off and do Candy, and it didn't mean any detraction from Beatles. They could still come together and be Beatles, but they could also do their own things separately.
And then at that point where John says, "I want a divorce," did Paul, do you think in the meeting that was taken as a final, or would they just have been, that Paul be thinking, well, this is just another John's, you know, today he wants a divorce, you know, then he thinks he's,
I don't know,
Jesus Christ, or
I mean, they all did change their minds, as we all do in life.
Yeah.
And again, you look at it from history and you're kind of looking for hard and fast things, but life isn't always like that.
I suppose we all want a point at which we can say, well, this is the definitive point at which there was no hope that they would ever get back together again.
I know that the others, I saw this expressed somewhere, they thought that John might come back.
Mm.
And they waited and they waited and he didn't. And then by, when did Ringo begin Sentimental Journey? Was it late 69?
Late 69, yeah.
Yeah, and Paul began the McCartney album basically at Christmas time.
But there's always that outlier session that I learnt about from your sessions book, that 2nd and 3rd of July 70 session, which we talked about on a previous podcast.
January 3rd, 4th.
Where they do I Me Mine.
Yes, and Let It Be.
Yeah, were they expecting John to turn up to that? He was in Denmark at the time.
He was in Denmark, but I now realise that he wasn't going to be there anyway.
Okay.
Had he been, I mean, he was away, so that's why we always think he wasn't there, but I have a feeling he wouldn't have been there anyway.
Yeah.
Because he had gone.
Yeah.
And but they just hadn't said anything.
It is odd. Like, I mean, I often think of the Beatles as almost like, you know, almost like being a college, you know. So you intend to keep in touch, and it's very easy to just,
yes,
once the balloon goes up in the air, it's very easy for it to just dissipate and end. And you get a feeling of that from the September to April period, that it's just, it becomes the new normal.
It becomes a limbo period, really,
because
they're not together, but we think they are, and they've got another album coming out, but they're actually already broken up.
Yeah,
so and they're sort of preserving the public face, that no one's saying this.
No one said anything until Paul put out his press release, and the others were miffed, John in particular, that it came out in that way. But obviously someone needed to say something at some point.
Do you think that the McCartney album, what I find interesting about the McCartney album is it's got those little snippets of instrumental tracks, and then suddenly you have fully realised, you know, Maybe I'm Amazed or Every Night. Was he always intending that to be an album, and was he intending it to be an album in the sense that Electronic Sound or Life with the Lions, it was a little experimental thing that was going to run in parallel with the Beatles? And then for me it always seemed that once Instant Karma, Cold Turkey, Instant Karma, they're directly commercially in competition with the Beatles, and then he thinks, well, I better put some proper songs on this, and that's the shift. But it strikes me that maybe originally it was going to be just a little throwaway experimental.
I don't know. Only Paul would know the answer to that. And also Adrian Sinclair and Alan Cozin, who are writing what I know is going to be the Paul McCartney from the early 70s. We'll get our answers from that, I think, because that will be the right one. And they know much more about that period than I do. But I think to me, the McCartney album was always just a reflection of who he is. I mean, he can do beautiful short songs, he can do beautiful long songs, and he can do just little fragments of things, and he just kind of threw them in. So I don't think it was in his mind. I wouldn't imagine in his mind it was like an experimental album. It was just an expression of what
he wanted to do.
And here are some complete songs and here are some fragments.
So,
but it was very disappointing at the time. We were just discussing this earlier over breakfast, that I can't, as someone, I'm going off topic here, but
no, work away.
As someone for whom the early 70s was current,
yes,
and not something I'm viewing from history, but actually living through it, I can't stress strong enough how, at the time, for all of us who were alive and experiencing those works in their moment of release, all those early McCartney singles and albums were disappointing.
Yes.
They were. From history now, they're fine.
Yeah.
But in the moment, everyone was so disappointed in them, and that included me.
Well, I've said it on the podcast before, because I became a Beatles and McCartney fan in the 80s, that at the time, I was very annoyed that I wasn't around to experience the Beatles in the 60s. But I also believe that McCartney's solo career is best enjoyed in retrospect. That, you know, you can kind of look back at the whole soup now and go, you can relax about McCartney and Ram because, you know, there's a Band on the Run coming, or there's, you know, whatever tickles your fancy, a Tug of War. And, you know, so there's a total difference between, you know, the Beatles, you kind of feel that desire to be tied to the time, you know, what it would have been like. But with McCartney, you're like, actually, no, I can just get lost in certain corners of his career for a period of time.
Yes.
And everything's all right.
You can, and everything is all right. And I really enjoy the Wildlife album now in a way that I didn't at the time.
I'm
not a believer, but even but like you say, I came to that, you know, I was listening to Speed of Sound, London Town, and then I bought Wildlife. And it's so completely unrelated to this. The sound is different, the lack of lyrics, everything is so different from that very polished late 70s silly love songs with a little luck sound but I still find it difficult to get past that sort of the baggage and the reputation that it had. I remember reading the Enemy Encyclopedia of Rock, and they were describing Wildlife as being an appalling album. Ram was the lowest point of 60s rock. And so you still, I still have that in the back of my mind.
Yes, it's hard to disassociate it if you know that. But if you live through it, the McCartney album was disappointing, even though it's got some wonderful tracks on it. I mean, in the moment, we went from Eleanor Rigby to Penny Lane to Sgt. Pepper to Fool on the Hill and Lady Madonna and Hey Jude and all the tracks on the White Album, and then The Glory of Abbey Road, and then suddenly we've got Crina Craw and tracks like that. And okay, they're fine, and any artist can do anything, and it is valid, and I'm not in any way, but the moment we all went, oh
yes,
we really did, and when's he going to make something good? And of course we knew he was capable of it, and by our definition of good, those new tracks weren't it. And then we went to Another Day, then Ram, which sounds lush and great now, but in its moment it was so disappointing.
Yes.
And then Wildlife was another step down, and Give Ireland Back to the Irish, I'm trying to do it in order, Mary Had a Little Lamb, it's just like, what is this guy on? Where is Paul McCartney now?
Yes.
And we all, Band on the Run was, we revered so much, partly out of relief.
You wanted it to be good.
We wanted it to be good. So at last, Paul McCartney is back.
Yeah.
But from history, those early works are fine.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd almost say it's a pity that I enjoy those moments when McCartney just tips his head onto a tape and whatever comes out, you know, because he tends to react afterwards. If he does a McCartney 2, he does take criticism on board of these things. His antenna is very tuned to all of this kind of stuff. Now, we're kind of gotten away from Hornsey Road, but
we have.
I suppose the other question is, has this given you a taste to do any of the other albums? Surely there's a more than 2 hours to talk about Get Back and Let It Be and all that.
Yeah, I think I'll probably leave that one to Apple, because they're doing the new film.
Yes.
Peter Jackson's film, I'm sure, will cover it very well.
Yes.
And we're going to get all of that next year. I hope next year. It probably will be next year.
It is a nice reminder with these 50th anniversaries, just how close these albums came out in real life.
Yeah.
It really feels like a few weeks since I bought the White Album box.
Yes.
And now we're all buying the Abbey Road box set. It's an extraordinary reminder of that.
Or even the 50th anniversary of Love Me Do doesn't seem that far away.
60th?
50th.
From way back, yes.
Yeah, it doesn't seem... on the Let It Be box, am I right in saying that you did a lot of work back in 2001, 2002 on Let It Be, on the film, or were working at that stage?
Yes, at that time, the DVD was being considered, and I don't know if it had a target release date. It wasn't my business to know that. That was Neil Aspinall sorting things out, but they did all the interviews for the extras for the DVD, and that's where I was involved and interviewed Michael Lindsay Hogg and Neil, and the two policemen who went up on the roof to stop the show or to ask them to turn down the PA, and who else? Oh, quite a few people. But then it never happened.
So that was already sort of prepped, and or at least
at
a reasonably advanced stage.
Whether they're going to use any of that next year, I have no idea. I did The Help at the same time, and those were used. So if you look at The Help DVD, there's an interview with Neil on there. That's my interview.
Okay.
Whether they'll use the Let It Be stuff, I don't know. They may just redo it. I also did Magical Mystery Tour with Apple, and when they eventually put that out, they did it all again.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so we'll just have to wait and see what future projects or presentations you do beyond Hornsey Road.
Well, I probably will do something.
Yeah.
I mean, the reality of writing a very long and all these years series is a 30-plus year project for me, is that when you write books, you get paid on a publication and on delivery of manuscript. So the last check I had of any substance was on publication of Tune In, which is now 6 years ago.
Right.
And my next check will be when I deliver the manuscript for Volume 2, which will be in the future. And I don't know exactly when, but quite some distance into the future. So it's just like, how on earth do I eat in the meantime? And this is an attempt to basically give me the money to carry on writing.
Okay.
And people say, well, why don't you do crowdfunding? Well, that's not fair, because I've already had a publisher's advance. And I don't, crowdfunding isn't me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm too old for crowdfunding. My head is in a previous generation.
Yes. Yeah.
A young person might think of crowdfunding, but I don't think of crowdfunding as valid for me.
But also you've got cachet and name value in terms of your historical work and what you've done so far. So,
yes.
You know, there was a room full of people last night who were like, that's the guy.
My idea of crowdfunding is to have people pay £20, which is not that expensive for a night out, and I'll give you a 2.5 hour show.
Yeah.
For your money, and then you've given me your money and you've gone away with something.
Okay. Mm. We might rewind back, because one of the things myself and Stephen were talking about, you know, before you coming into us today, was how did you start doing all of this? And I know I've heard you talk before saying that you were born in the late 50s and you were acutely aware of the Beatles as they were happening as a kid.
Mm.
And I've wondered, because I know I've said this a few minutes ago, that I had this ache that I didn't experience the Beatles in real time. How important has that been for you as a biographer to have experienced that in real time? And do you have any insight into people like me who didn't get to experience in real time?
With regard to the second half of that, I mean, I understand that. I mean, I'm a big fan of things that occurred before I was born.
Yes.
So, yes, you just can't. You have to accept that you can't have that experience of things being freshly released and going out and get them on the day of release and so on. And not knowing what's coming next is the big one.
Yes.
Mm. Because the Beatles, as viewed from history, we kind of, though we don't know the history as well as we think we do,
mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to address in these books, we do know the overall pattern. We do know the chronology, the headlines. So,
yeah.
But in the moment, you can't know tomorrow. So that excitement of knowing of Sgt. Pepper being something that you didn't know about yesterday and suddenly today you're holding it in your hand and playing it, that is something that is a valuable experience, I think.
And that's something I've loved about the books, is that you do try and write, you know, obviously people coming to your books will know, oh, stuff happens, but there's none of this kind of coy, oh, and just around the corner this was about to happen. There's a very strict kind of procedural approach to it.
Yes, I was intent from the very outset of not anticipating what's coming next for the reader. So I sow a lot of seeds that will flower later in the story, and because that's necessary. But because they didn't know what was coming tomorrow, so too did I write it that way and keep to it strictly.
Mm.
So none of this, because I can't stand it when people say things like, little did they know
yeah.
that in 8 years' time they would be doing this. Well, they didn't know it.
Yeah.
And that wasn't why they were doing whatever they were doing, in order to anticipate something 8 years later.
Yeah.
Life isn't lived like that. And it's much more understandable as a story if you tell it in that strict way.
Okay. So when you encountered the Beatles as a kid, was it immediately this is it, or was it just part of the panoply of records you were buying as a kid?
They were head and shoulders above everybody else. I did buy other 45s. 45s was where it was at in the 60s.
Mm.
Singles were really much more important than LPs. Everything is viewed now through album, the prism of albums. But the singles were really what people knew.
Yeah.
Albums were bought by, you know, relatively a fraction of those who bought singles. Singles were played on the radio, album tracks hardly ever.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to buy the albums to hear those tracks. So you knew the singles, and I knew the singles as they happened. And but I was a child, so I didn't have much money. But it was easy for people to buy me presents, because they always knew what I wanted, which was, you know, the next Beatles record will do me fine, thank you. And there's no greater gift. I mean, those little pieces of 7-inch plastic are the absolute embodiment of what made the Beatles so special.
Mm.
In a sense, more than the albums, I would say.
Okay.
Because, I mean, these beautiful 2-2.5 minute tracks that they just kept dropping into the world, with a brilliant B-side as well.
It is still impressive after all these years that, you know, the way people say, oh, you know, Queen were a great singles act and so-and-so is a great albums act. The Beatles were two separate acts. They were a great singles act and a great albums act. Even Please Please Me from the Start is an album that there's a definite before and after in terms of album releases when that comes out.
Yes.
So they're running two parallel careers, and I know that's something we come back to. That's there's so many different ways you can kind of approach the Beatles and just enjoy them that way, as a young band, as an old band, or whatever you feel. So how does that then evolve into, you know, becoming a historian or a writer about it?
Just, I don't know.
That's a huge question, I guess, unless you have any more specifics.
Well, we were talking about the Beatles Monthly and Sean O'Mahony, the sort of reissues and but is that the point where you first started writing about the Beatles for Beatles Monthly?
Yes, yes.
And so how did that, did you approach them?
Yes, I think I did. I used to buy it in the 60s. I had some odd issues, but it was in, I think, number 54, January 68, that I first started to buy it every month routinely. And I used to cycle around to a newsagent's near me every first of the month, and it was £2, I think. And I got my name in it.
Okay.
In those days,
I think, back in 68
or 69, I'm in there in the list of people who wanted pen pals.
Ah.
I was in there a couple of times. And then it stopped and life moved on. But in 1976, he revived it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going into the office just before the first revived issue came out, which was, I think, May 76, just to go into the office and say hello, basically. I don't know quite why I went, but picked up a copy of the magazine. And then in that December... Well, the first Beatles convention in the UK happened in August 76 at Norwich, and I went to that, and I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a second one in December. But being a Beatles fan in the UK was really difficult then. There weren't many of us left. Mm-hmm. We'd been reduced down to a solid core. Some of us still see each other, and we know that we're like old veterans now. Because in that period before John Lennon was killed, the Beatles were so passé, or so it seemed.
Yes.
And we were clinging to it. I was still current in other ways. I did listen to new music, but I wasn't just living in the Beatles world. But I did love the Beatles and didn't want to let it go. And the convention in London was very poorly attended. It was in the wrong venue, Alexandra Palace, in the Great Hall, which held
very
thousands.
Massive, yeah.
And it was just before Christmas, and it was cold, and it was the 1970s. And there were about, I don't know, 100 people there,
maybe.
We were rattling around. It was a complete flop financially. But as part of it, there was this quiz called Beatles Brain of Europe. Who knew more about them than anybody else? And I went in for it, and I won it. And then I got in touch with Johnny Dean, Sean O'Mahony, and said, I've won the quiz. Is there anything I can do for you? And there was, because with the magazine Revive, they were getting a lot of letters from readers asking particular questions. You know, when was so-and-so released? Can you inform me, you know, what schools did they go to? And he didn't really have that factual knowledge. He'd run the magazine, but he was a publisher. He wasn't a Beatles fan, particularly. So, though he liked them, but he didn't have a body of knowledge in his head. So he used to pay me £1 per letter to give the answers that were published.
And this was, for those who don't know, the magazine was republished with a sort of a wraparound, three or four pages back in front.
Yeah, four pages at the front and four at the back.
New material.
Yes.
At least new written material.
So. Yes. So it would be Johnny Dean says, but I would write it for him.
Okay.
And type it. And he would pay me £1 per letter if it got published, which was great. I got paid.
That's where it all began.
It's always nice to be paid for something.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the little acorn that leads us to today, I suppose.
Yeah. And then I started to do bits of writing, but I really wasn't a writer. I didn't know how to write. I wasn't fluent as a writer then.
Yeah.
But I worked into it, so...
And just to touch upon the thing you talked about there, the Beatles in the 70s is a weird conundrum. And, you know, I think, you know, they showed like a roadmap to all bands in the 60s about how you're supposed to do things. And I think unbeknownst to them in the 70s, they were kind of laying the groundwork as to how you split up. You know, people hadn't really figured out business arrangements or structures or reissues or any of those kind of things.
Yeah.
And again, even though they're not, they're like Schrodinger's Beatles, they're existing and not existing and they're kind of moving forward.
Yeah.
And people are trying to figure out how to monetize this thing. And but it's a big myth that there was going to be another Beatles. I always find this amusing when they say, well, you know, T-Rex are the new Beatles. Like, there wasn't even another Beatles when the Beatles were around, you know?
But, yes.
What do you think was the thing, though, that kind of started to tip things the other way? Was it really John's death in 1980, or could you feel rumblings towards the end of the 70s? Because we start getting all these reissues and compilations and all that in the late 70s.
Yeah, but I don't think the reissues and compilations... First of all, every country is different.
Yeah.
So I can mostly speak of Britain. But, I mean, in America, they were always bigger through the 70s. Their influence didn't diminish, and they were still big. They were still a hot act through the 70s in America when they were not in the UK.
Is that due to American radio having a longer tail, or is there...
I guess so, and also they don't have that same eagerness to move on and turn their back on things that are special as we do in Britain. I don't know if it's true for Ireland, but that kind of cynicism that you move on quickly and that's last year, you know. And the whole format of oldies radio and so on was so established in America, and FM being different from AM, and just a different market, really, and different mindset in the listener, in the population at large. But for me, unquestionably, it was John Lennon's death that changed it.
Yeah.
And when John Lennon released Double Fantasy, there wasn't a lot of interest in that. Not in the UK. I mean, maybe elsewhere, but no, not really. It was okay, yeah, that was it.
I remember buying Double Fantasy when it came out. I didn't actually buy it. I mean, I remember it coming out, and it was there was just disinterest, I think, in the music papers. It there was a huge build up, I think, in America, but in the UK, and I didn't, you know, I was a huge Beatles fan, but I didn't buy that record, and I didn't buy the single until after January 81. Simply, it was just a non-event.
Yes,
really.
The Beatles convention in Liverpool, which had the first one of those, was in 1977, and it was organised by the great Alan Williams and the great Bob Wooler. But still, you know, 100 people maybe, but in a smaller venue, so it worked and it was good. And these events carried on sporadically through to 80, but as soon as John Lennon died, the 81 convention was like massive. And so I have no doubt that that was when the shift occurred.
And so in that phase, you know, you're moving towards writing your first book. And I guess, you know, finding information at that time is different to how we find information now. And The Beatles Live, is that just a book you wrote to satisfy your own curiosity? Because once these questions start coming, you kind of, it must have been hard to believe that nobody really wrote this stuff down.
Yes, well, none of the Beatles kept a diary. And unlike, say, Bill Wyman in the Stones, who was a record keeper and a keeper of papers and so on, the Beatles just lived their life and they weren't looking back at all. Yeah. So it wasn't that far earlier. You know, late 1970s is only a few years after the Beatles had broken up, but it seemed like eons. And I just started to research their live dates, initially on a commission from Philip Norman, to find the date that John met Paul.
All right.
And to find the dates when the Beatles toured in Scotland with Johnny Gentle. But having satisfied his inquiries, I was just so consumed with the research of it all and the joy of the discovery of the knowledge that I just carried on.
Yeah.
And that's real library work.
Yes. But I mean, you're literally going to libraries and looking at papers. I know you referred to this in the Hornsey Road Show, but that's still the meat and potatoes of how you get this done.
It is. I mean, the internet obviously is an incredible resource. I mean, that goes without saying. But it's there for everybody. And if you really want to find something that only you can find and that isn't generally available, then you need to go and do it yourself. Mm-hmm. You need to go and... Not everything is online. Far from it. It's only still a fraction of what there was.
Yeah.
So I like going to places and looking through papers and, you know, going through the show is called Hornsey Road because of my discovery in the archives of EMI that they were going to kick out of everything except classical music from Abbey Road and buy this studio on Hornsey Road, and pop would have been recorded there, including the Beatles.
Yeah.
So they would never have recorded at Abbey Road, and it came close. There's only about 4 years before they come along, 4 or 5 years. And I only found that out because I thought I'd go through the board meeting minutes of EMI, and why start in the 60s? Because thinking, corporate thinking, you know, takes years to percolate through. So I started in the 50s, not looking for anything. I had no idea what I was going to find. I quite possibly was going to find nothing of any interest whatsoever. And a fair bit of research time is spent finding nothing.
Yeah.
But if you don't look, then A, you don't find, and B, you'll always have that doubt in the back of your mind that there was something you didn't look for, look at, that might have been useful.
I have to admit, the Hornsey Road bit was probably my favourite bit, because I used to live where Hornsey Road bisects Tollington Road.
Oh.
And I used to live...
right there.
Yeah, I used to live right there. And when you put up the pictures, I'm like, oh, that's down the road from the Sabell Health Centre, right?
Yeah.
I was like, that's insane that this was around, because one of the reasons I moved to the Holloway Road area was because of Joe Meek. I thought, well, we'll see where Joe Meek works.
Right.
And I thought this was hilarious that I lived around the corner from Joe Meek's old studio.
Yes.
But I didn't know that it could have been the Abbey Road at the time. So that really struck me, because I knew that place very, very well.
I mean, it's a bit obscure to name the show that, but I always take lead from the Beatles in that they never did anything obvious.
Yes.
And to call this show Abbey Road, I mean, yeah, I mean, okay, but
yeah,
it's not clever enough. Not for a show title.
Needs to be a deep cut of information.
Yeah, so I thought Hornsey Road, The Making of Abbey Road, or something like that would just come at it differently.
Okay. So when The Beatles Live comes out, are you already on the radar of EMI, Apple, Beatles organisations at that point, or how do you kind of transition then into, you know, kind of the next, what I would kind of say almost is the next phase of the work, like the Sessions book and the Day by Day book and all those things?
Well, going back to the Beatles Monthly in 1979, late 79, so it's right 40 years ago like now, I offered to Sean O'Mahony a monthly news compendium, Beatles 79. You know, whatever I'd been able to find about what was going on in the lives of these four guys and the world around them in the past month. And it, so current news and events. And in that magazine, which was principally still a reissue of the 60s mag, it was the only bit that was truly current about, you know, what's new record coming out next month and he's about to go off on tour or whatever. And as a consequence of that, I would routinely contact the record companies and press offices, asking, you know, is there anything happening that I can write about? And so that's how I got to know EMI. So when the recording, I had that relationship with EMI right through the early 80s of me writing about whatever they were doing, mm-hmm. and then beginning to ask me questions about the consulting with me, like when the 20th anniversary reissues came out from 82 onwards of Love Me Do and mm-hmm. Please Please Me. I was kind of consulted on that. I can't remember quite how or what, but I was part of the process slightly.
Yeah.
And so I knew all the people at EMI who were on. They used to have a Beatles committee.
Oh, right, okay.
Which they always denied the existence of, and I'd love to see the minutes of the meetings of the Beatles committee, because they would be fascinating to read. And they must exist somewhere, but and I hope one day they get out, but I don't have them. But I know that my name would have been coming up at those meetings, so when eventually EMI as a company decided to do a book about the Beatles recording sessions, I think my name was just in the frame as to someone that who could do it.
Yeah.
And also the Beatles Live had shown EMI that something as relatively dry as a list of dates and places could be made into a readable book.
Yes.
And what they had with the session data was something that on paper was quite dry but could be enlivened into a good narrative.
But you must see that now that you started a genre of book. Like there's, you know, you can buy Kinks Day by Day and Who Day by Day and all that kind of stuff. That's your,
the Chronicle,
one of your shadows.
The Chronicle really is that. I know immediately there was a Rolling Stone Sessions book and an ABBA Sessions book and a few others. And then the Beatles Chronicle, which was a folding together of a lot of my research. That has led to quite a few other similar type books. But they were actually the ideas of publishers, not me.
Okay.
But the recording sessions book, I've read a few of the other sort of the Stones, but there's not the same level of detail. But is that simply because EMI were the sort of bureaucratic record keepers that other studios weren't?
Yes. Well, I personally thrive on detail, and I always think that detail can be used to enliven something rather than to drag it down.
Yes.
But absolutely, you're right. It was the fact that as an operation, EMI was good at keeping records of what it did. So there were all the recording sheets were there in filing cabinets in a corridor at the studios, which I used to just go and ransack. And everything was filed by job number, and there was a book that was an index of all the job numbers. And so I would just, Beatles, and it's 1069 or whatever, and I'd go through the filing cabinet and pull out the file.
I mean, it seems staggering that that information was still there, that at some point someone hadn't said, we should just be getting rid of that, or we should be clearing that out, or we could use that room for something else, or we could...
It's there for every session, though. It's not just Beatles information, it's everybody's information.
Everybody, absolutely. All the artists who recorded at Abbey Road, and that paperwork is all still kept.
And is it, back in the 80s, was it still physically in Abbey Road? I know this is a dull question, but it was all physically on site in that building.
It was literally in filing cabinets that didn't, where the ball bearings had gone, and you had to really kind of yank them open and then kind of shove it back in again because it was off its rails.
Yeah.
But it was as easy as that. And then they're all protected now.
Yes.
But they were unprotected then, in a sense. The filing cabinets weren't even locked.
Yeah, people could adjust.
But this, people didn't steal.
Yes.
I mean, I dare say the odd thing had gone missing, but I don't know about. But it, in theory, it was just all there, available.
I mean, the whole story of Abbey Road, the building itself, like, we were at the Abbey Road presentation, one of those presentations in August, and the fact that, you know, there was almost all this work done in the early 80s to knock it and renovate it, and but they pressed pause. There's this kind of shift towards understanding legacy a bit better in the 80s.
Yes.
Yes. Illinois. Well, this is what I'm wondering. Is the Sessions book a key part of that? That this is the point at which EMI suddenly start to realize exactly the value of what they have in terms of their archive? Because it does seem to me that it coincides with what you did for in preparing and the research for the Sessions book, that suddenly that's the point at which EMI as an organization suddenly realizes, well, we shouldn't have this in open filing cabinets with broken ball bearings, or we should be doing something with this, and we need to preserve that. And it sort of coincides with I forget the name of the chap who put the brakes on the redevelopment
was it Ken Townsend?
Ken. Probably Ken. Yeah. He was general manager of the studio, Ken Townsend.
That's the point at which they suddenly realise we need to do something. Whereas up to that point, one of the things we talked about on a previous episode was the sort of slightly careless approach of EMI to compilation albums and rock and roll and love songs and ballads. And then suddenly they start to realise what it is they have. And that comes in the mid-80s, around the time of...
I think the two things are running in parallel. I think they were aware of what we would now call legacy and Abbey Road Studios, which is always a difficult one for the studio because it is a real working studio.
It's a working,
and you have to be cutting edge to get the work, you know, in any sphere. You know, otherwise a competitor studio will get it instead. Yeah. But at the same time, number two studio and number one, only number three has significantly changed. Numbers one and two studios there are still much as they were by appearance, but in the control room, they've got everything is up to date. Mm. The control room is modern, but the studio floor itself is pretty much as it was, and it was never a lot. It was all fairly Spartan in the first place, and it's still Spartan.
That was what surprised me. We were there a few months ago, and it was just a big space and a few chairs and these instruments scattered around. There was no luxury to it. There was nothing. That was very interesting.
And the Beatles weren't expecting luxury, but they did begin to tire of Abbey Road's bureaucracy and the few frills that there were, the no frills that there were, they did tire of that. Because as they started to use independent studios that were made in the moment, they were going, well, you know, this is quite nice actually to record like this.
And then presumably there are fewer records available from Trident and Olympic, and when they do their sessions...
Comes back to your question. Yeah. EMI was a very good record keeper. They had almost all the tapes and they had almost all the sheets. They didn't have sheets for singles. They only had sheets for albums. If singles were recorded during album sessions, that was okay.
That was okay.
But there was no sheet, for example, for the Please Please Me session or the From Me to You session. But there, you could get Hey Jude, not Hey Jude, but Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields, because they were just recording.
It was part of it, yeah.
The sheets for those. But other than carping on about a few things that weren't there, the majority of things were there. But as soon as the Beatles stepped out into Trident or Olympic or any places, Delane Lee, there's no paperwork at all. And it just makes you appreciate the value of EMI in keeping records.
And the Sessions book was very much an EMI project, so Apple didn't have any involvement at that stage?
No, and in fact that comes back to what you were saying just now, because in the 80s EMI was doing all these compilations, Beatles ballads, Beatles 20 greatest hits and so on, and Apple, the Beatles, had no mechanism to stop this. The recordings were owned by EMI, that was unequivocally true, and they didn't have to consult. And the Beatles were watching these things coming out and going, oh, God, not another one. And they had no consultation over the artwork or anything. Mm-hmm. And EMI wasn't trying to be crass, but they were trying to make money. Mm. And so they would routinely be another issue of something, or, you know, I don't mean the track something, or a box set of the singles, you know, picture discs and cassette singles and 3-inch CD singles. And Apple couldn't stop any of that. And the final straw for Apple was when EMI put out that cassette tape called Only the Beatles that you would get free with
Heineken Lager
ring pulls or something like that. And they drew the line there and went, whoa, you know, our music is not to be given away with beer cans. And it must have seemed like a good idea at the time. As an active record company, EMI had a promotions department, probably had a meeting with the brewers of Heineken, and somehow or other that went through. But the Beatles just went, no, that's one step too far. And that was added to a whole string of legal problems that had existed between them for many years. And that all got settled in 1989. And from that point to this day, EMI doesn't do anything Beatle-wise without Apple saying yes or no to that idea. And and the recording sessions book just came before that settlement. Probably, possibly, had Apple been controlling EMI a little bit earlier, Beatles-wise, that book wouldn't have happened.
And at that time, though, weren't Apple themselves, in terms of... there was a Paul versus George Ringo Yoko issue as well internally in Apple, was there?
Was this the override fallout, the Dorchester? That was earlier?
83. That big meeting was 83, where they discovered Paul's override,
I'd only recently realised that that override was from 75. Mm-hmm. I thought it dated from his re-signing in Capitol in the sort of 80, was it 1980 he re-signed? Or
after he left Columbia.
Columbia, yeah. But I hadn't realised it dated all the way back to 1975.
80s. Yeah, but I'm 99% certain that I've seen the contract. So, yes, I'm 99% certain it goes back to that contract. So I may be wrong, but I don't think so.
So for people who don't know what that is, could you explain? This is where Paul was getting a little bit extra every time a Beatles record was sold.
Paul re-signed with Capitol. I mean, all the Beatles contracts were up for renewal. The 67 agreement bound them as individuals as well as a band for 9 years until January 1976. So in 1974-5, with the end of contracts in view, they all had approaches from various record companies to sign with them. And Paul had a good offer from Warner Brothers, and I don't know, probably every company. And they all did. They all did. And Ringo went off and signed with Atlantic Records in America and Polydor for the rest of the world, as I remember it. And George signed with initially A&M and then with Warner's. And Paul stayed with EMI Capital. And as part of his new contract, which was obviously a very good contract by the 70s, because 70s music contracts were wholly different from 60s contracts for everybody, he had a clause added that gave him an extra royalty on Beatles record sales as well. So when a Beatles record sold, John would get X, George would get X, Ringo would get X, and Paul would get X plus Y.
And that Y was coming from the record company's share. It wasn't that the other three were getting any less. It was just that he was getting something
more
extra.
That sounds totally fair.
But you could see... Do we know how that became known to the other three?
I don't know that. I don't know that. And I don't know that John ever knew it in his lifetime.
That's what I was wondering. Was it after?
I believe it was.
After 1980.
Because, well, the big meeting that came about once George, Ringo and Yoko found out about Paul's override, that meeting was 83. So I imagine they'd only just found out, but I don't know how they found out.
That was reported as a big reunion. Wasn't it reunion rumours as the Beatles meeting in Dorchester and they were just...
I remember photographs of George coming out of the Dorchester. Not looking happy.
It must have been... And Paul was working with Ringo at that time on the Broad Street. And that relationship had to maintain until the film was released. They felt, look, I wasn't at the meeting and it's their lives and not mine, but my understanding is, and it seems sensible to realise, that they felt that that was a betrayal of their ethos. That they had always divided everything equally, and then suddenly one of them was a bit more equal than the others. Yes, it wasn't coming out of their pot, but nonetheless it was they felt it. I'm sure they felt it. I know they felt
it. Didn't pass the smell test,
but it was underhand. Yeah, yeah.
It seemed to me that there was a parallel there with Paul acquiring a few more shares in Northern Songs, and the animosity, and when Lennon found out that suddenly Paul had been acquiring some additional beans,
yes,
there that was no longer an equal split, and that was a great source of animosity. It was very comparable.
It was pretty much the same thing.
Would you think? I mean, I'm sort of again getting wildly off topic, but I mean, would you speculate that Paul didn't appreciate that would cause a problem, or that he just looks at things in a different way? Because I remember him, he said, "Well, you could have done this if you wanted to. You could have done the same thing. Mm. It's just smart business."
Well, Paul seems like the great compartmentalizer. You know, that's my, as a fan, that's what I see, that he's able to say, today I'm famous Paul, today I'm business Paul, today I'm family Paul, and he just, you know, it switches those things on and off. I don't know whether that's right or wrong.
I think probably right. I don't know. I mean, we're all accountable for our own actions, and they're often... nobody else can actually know. You have to be inside his head.
It just struck me that the very fact that it was secret until it emerges,
yes,
probably compounded the issue.
If it has to be secret,
it has to be secret.
The fact that yes, exactly that. I mean, if it was something he could have been, if he was at ease with his own action there in taking more, then he wouldn't have kept it quiet.
Yeah, you know?
So he would have just said to the others, look, I've got a bit more because I re-signed. Yeah. You could have done the same. And I'm sure that's probably what he said in 83.
Yeah.
But because it was held back from them, obviously it was something that he probably knew would inflame them.
Hmm.
So by 88, 89, where the EMI-Apple relationship has changed and Recording Sessions has just come out, and then your next step after Recording Sessions, is that when you begin an association with Apple directly at that point?
I began one with Paul first, because when The Beatles Live came out, he really liked that book. He really liked that book. And he and Ringo in particular, would a couple of the anecdotes in that book would become part of their storytelling. they loved the fact that that I reported that The Beatles had played a gig in Preston in September 63. And after the gig, Paul had driven off to judge a beauty contest. And if they ever knew that, I mean, Paul would have known it because he did it. But in the weight of everything else happening,
they get forgotten. Detail gets forgotten.
And suddenly he read that in the book and he loved it. And he and Ringo laughed about it. And they both mentioned that in interviews afterwards about judging a beauty contest and all that. And I knew they got that from the book. So that was very pleasing for me. And
you were telling me he signed a copy of the book for you.
He did. He did, and honestly, I can't remember what he wrote, but it was something like the best Beatle book ever, and signed it all the breast, Paul McCartney. And I think he actually put 10 out of 10 at the bottom as well, like a school teacher, which was nice. And then I interviewed him for the Recording Sessions book, and we got along very easily, and he enjoyed the questions being, you know,
a fantastic interview, I think. I remember my own, if I can be personal for a second, when I was 14 at Christmas 88, I had a voucher to spend after Christmas, and I bought the White Album and the Beatles Sessions book.
Right.
And that is basically, that has made all the difference. Mm. But I remember reading that interview at the time, and I think there's stuff in that interview that you just, he's talking in a way that you haven't really... See, he's quite interested in technique and process.
He's very at ease in that interview, I think.
Yeah, he was. Straight away, we actually did, because I'd met him once before, and because he had The Beatles Live, because I was writing the Sessions book, and I gave him a list of all the people I was interviewing, and they were all engineers and people like that at the studios that he had long relationships with and knew that they could be trusted. So he knew this book was going to be an okay book, because they took a very dim view of Beatle books after John died. Paul in particular took a very dim view. Post 81 really is when the Beatles literature explodes into what it became, and they were unhappy with a lot of those books.
The Peter Brown book was a big no-no, wasn't it?
It was for them.
Yeah.
It was for them, yeah. I mean, it educated a lot of other people, but for them it was, they had problems with that book.
Yeah.
And so when I was working with Paul, when I did that interview with him, he said, well, I actually had a call from his PA to say Paul is thinking of doing his autobiography and he wants to do it with you.
Mm.
So we'll put you under contract and we'll pay you and you'll be available for Paul whenever he needs you. And I went, okay. Fine.
Yeah, sounds like a good one.
Yeah, and I was very happy. I mean, I'd last been in regular employment in a paid job where someone gives you a paycheck and gives you salary and holiday pay and sick leave and so on 5 years earlier, and I was thinking I could probably eke 5 years out of my different ideas.
Yeah.
And suddenly it was opening up in front of me now. I could just carry on doing this.
So you're kind of on call then for interviewing and talking to Paul, or are you let loose on MPL archives, or what kind of happened?
No, I was just, when he was ready to do his book, I was lined up.
Oh, okay.
And then in the end, he never did that book.
Yes.
And I've said this in a couple of interviews elsewhere, so I won't go into too much into it, but I think I probably talked him out of it inadvertently. Because I was asked to put together a little briefing document about what his book should be.
Okay.
And I always aim very high. And I aim very high on his behalf so that his book would be the very greatest of music autobiographies ever. It would absolutely set the benchmark.
Mm.
But obviously it would require time and effort to do that. And I think he probably just...
And is this the time when a Beatles biography starts germinating in your mind? Or is that still a few years away?
No, that was years away. The anthology came next.
Yeah.
After the settlement with EMI and Apple, with Apple now holding control over how things are going to be done, that's when Neil Aspinall started to evolve his Long and Winding Road film into the Beatles anthology. But the greatest impetus for the anthology was George's business problems.
Yes.
Because he was suddenly short of money, relatively so.
Yes.
In the early 90s, and needed a bit of Beatles income.
Yeah, so he was on the ropes because of Handmade Pictures and
Dennis O'Brien.
Dennis O'Brien.
Mm.
And that's where we're going to put a pause on the first half of our Mark Lewison interview. We're going to put the next half out in a week's time, next Wednesday, on the regular Nothing Is Real release day. In the interim, we remain online in the normal places at BeatlesPod on Twitter. Go on to the Facebook and look for the Nothing Is Real Facebook group. You can join us there. And don't forget to leave your nice reviews wherever you get your podcasts. But until next week, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.